Alice is walking in the city, and then you hear like smaller, louder footsteps. And then the way the roar of the panther becomes the roar of a public bus. Like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
it's about this fear about this urban landscape.
You're listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
Chad, how's it going?
I'm doing good. I was expecting a how are you, but how's it going? That's what that works.
Sorry, I wanted to switch it up.
Yeah, you totally caught me off guard. Now we're off script from the opening moments.
What script?
True. Yeah. No, I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm okay.
Yeah. I know last month you were not okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. We're probably still there, but I'm coming to New York next week. I'm excited about that. Going to see some movies.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've been to the New York Film Festival since we've talked last, too. I know we won't get into that too much on this one because we've got another one, but.
Yeah. So part of why I'm going to New York next week is to talk about that with Fran Hoffner for a special episode of the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast. Spoiler.
That's going to be awesome. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I'm pretty excited. We saw some of the same films, but a lot of different ones also. And she saw way more than I did.
Yeah. She was covering it for a lot of places. So
I know. Yeah. It'll be cool.
Yeah. That does sound fun.
It's going to be a hoot, I'm sure.
Well, and that was your first time going as a, I don't know what you call it, media designated person?
Yeah, it was actually. And it was interesting. It was really weird to see so many film critics in real life, visually, physically, people who are basically avatars to me, because I don't actually follow a lot of film Twitter people on Instagram. So I don't really know what they look like.
Twitter bios come to life.
Yeah. And so I was very openly kind of looking at people's name, like passes and being like, oh my God, that's you.
Yes. We will definitely not name names then.
No. Well, we will on the on the other episode of the pod for sure. First and last socials.
Was there any like, oh my God, that's you? Or was it a...
Oh yeah, big time. Totally. And then also just like the vibe, I was expecting, I think, something more somber or like self-serious or something. Mm. And instead, it was just a lot of people in their 20s like getting up the second the credits started rolling. And I was like, oh, that's different from how I expected. But it was good. It was exhausting.
Yeah.
I don't think those seats are very comfortable in the Walter Reed to watch three features in a day. But it was nice. It was fun.
Veronica, I want to talk to you later. I heard there were like young 20s, like people on their phones at the New York Film Festival walking out of The Mother and the Whore.
That makes me crazy because that's a movie I was dying to see. And with my teaching schedule, I couldn't stay in New York to see it.
Oh,
and
no.
Yeah. And I was, shocking. That's like one of the ones that I was like just absolutely so, so yeah. sad to miss. Yeah.
Very
yeah.
shocking. When someone told me their walkouts, I was like, oh, old people, they're like, some, but also like young people on their phones.
Yeah, there was like a kind of impertinence. I'm really showing my age now, but to the whole thing. And I was like, whoa.
I love that. Yeah. So ready to be a crotchety old lady.
I know. Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
Well, that's cool. I'm glad you had an experience.
I had an experience. Yeah, that's accurate.
Cool. Yeah. So should we get into talking about our movie today?
Let's fucking do it.
Let's get into it.
It's B movies. This is a theme issue that's been curated by Bright Wall Dark Room editor Travis Woods, right?
Mr. Travis Woods, indeed. This is his baby.
Yeah.
He presented it to me a couple months ago and put on the full court press. And I said, nope, you don't need the full court press. I think it's going to be a good one. But understandably, there's a lot of those movies I haven't seen. So whereas, you know, the last 112 issues, I'd seen most of the movies, you know, in any issue. This one, I think I've seen like two so far.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of cool to actually read it as someone who has no idea what they are, and especially if I've not been involved in editing the pieces, that I get to almost experience what it's like to read Brightwall from the outside.
Oh, that's nice.
It's good. I've liked them. I've got a few films added to my list that I never would have thought of in a million years, and some I hadn't even heard of. So,
give me one example of a film that's been added to your list that you never would have thought of in a million years.
I didn't know it existed until this week. I'd read the submission on Submittable, but in more of a, you know, writing way instead of a content way, so I didn't take a lot of it in. And it was on a movie from, it was either 1982 or 1983. It's a movie called Siege. Siege?
Mm.
Siege? How would you say that?
I think Siege, right?
Siege? So Siege, it's a low-budget exploitation thriller from Canada, made in 1983. Mm. A lot of B-movies will have multiple titles as the video distributors try to get something that hits and gets some attention. So it was also called Self-Defense.
Mm.
And the title of the piece was just Your Last Defense is Self-Defense, Siege and Queer Resilience in the Age of Defund the Police. So
wow.
He really tackled a lot of stuff in that essay.
Cool.
But it was, it was just a really cool thing. I'd never heard of the movie before and now definitely going to be checking it out. And then there's a movie that Walter Cha wrote about called The Sentinel, which I vaguely was aware of but hadn't really heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also definitely want to check that one out too. So yeah, a lot of new stuff to me, which is a cool new experience to have after like 10 years of doing this. So
that's so great.
Yeah. And one of my favorite B-movies though, because I'm not nearly as wise in that area as Travis is, but it is the one we're talking about today. So I was excited. I was like thinking I'm going to have to watch some movie I'd never seen before and try to sound smart on it really quick. And instead I was like, no, this is how I found out about B-movies. This is something I've seen, 25 years ago and probably every 5 years since. So
amazing.
It's great. And I'm really happy to be able to talk about it. And I believe our guest suggested it. So it's even cooler because
that's right.
It doesn't feel like we forced it into something we wanted. She just picked a great one.
I know. Yep. It was picked by our guest. I'm so stoked about today's guest. I mean, not to embarrass her/you because I know that she's literally on the podcast listening to us introduce her right now. But this was an all-time get for me. Like when we started the podcast, when we made like dream lists of possible guests. So
I will vouch for that. I remember.
This is really, really exciting. So our guest today is Miriam Bale. Miriam is a writer, curator, film critic, and programmer, and most recently artistic director of Indie Memphis, a year-round screening and development initiative and an annual film festival whose profile I've been watching rise mostly on Twitter for years, and which just wrapped on October 24th, celebrating its 25th anniversary. Miriam's written on film for the New York Times, Sight and Sound, Film Comment, W, the list goes on. It's a pretty big deal. And she's programmed widely throughout and beyond New York City, including founding the La-Di-Da Festival, which from what I can tell is a bit of a blueprint for Miriam's work, which is as much about taste and style as it is about historical context and analytic rigor. And that is probably what I admire most about Miriam as a person in criticism, that in writing and in practice, she's not only reacting to films and film culture, but actively inventing, whether it's concepts like the persona swap film or ephemeral communities for like-minded enthusiasts. Welcome, Miriam.
Oh, Veronica. That was so nice. It's so nice to be here. That was such a nice introduction. I mean, especially noticing the style element that I think is so important in film.
So important.
And I've long admired in your writing and your enthusiasms too. So it's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's so cool to have you here.
We're honored. Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
It's great.
We never even recorded on this day of the week before. That's how
it's true.
We're willing to make any time we could for it.
Yeah, big time TGIF moment for the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast. So you picked Cat People, and this was among a kind of like little stable of possible options. So how did Cat People emerge? And like, tell us a little bit about your relationship to the film.
Yeah, well, you talked about B-movies. Mm-hmm. And I think initially B-movies and sort of, I think also genre films. And initially my mind went to, I love softcore. I love like pre-code. And I wanted to kind of merge them. But I was thinking about all these very obscure titles. Seemed like they would be even hard to find.
Oh, I saw the list. Yeah.
We're going to put them in the show notes for sure.
Yeah.
So I thought of something like, I'll be honest, my horror, I try to know a little bit about a lot of things, but horror is the one area where I just don't really claim any expertise because there's mm-hmm. so many people who know more than I do.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Veronica's the horror person.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. We're both drawn to this, especially watching it again because it's so psychological.
Totally. Yeah.
And when I rewatched it again, I don't rewatch this one that often. The one that I rewatch often with the same duo is I Walked with a Zombie.
Yeah.
And that's just one of my all-time favorites. But this one I hadn't seen in a while, and I very clearly, viscerally remembered when I first saw it, which was in Martin Scorsese's...
Oh, me too.
You too. Was Martin Scorsese's personal journey through American cinema or American film.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I found it.
Oh my gosh. And when I saw that like years ago, like probably like 20 years ago, that really more than anything else, maybe Rosenbaum, maybe Molly Haskell, but I really think that film was my entry, my door into real discovery and the way I watch things and just a specific path. Like that's how I discovered Jennifer Jones, who I've written about when he was talking about Duel in the Sun in that film.
Yeah.
I haven't rewatched it, but I just remember the pool scene. And that was the entry into like Marty saying psychosexual. So good. And it was like, I've never been the same.
Oh my God, I love that so much. Let's do synopsis of the film so we can just like get right into it.
Yeah, we have a very similar origin story then.
For people who haven't seen it, also it is streaming right now on HBO Max, so people can see it. Cat People from 1942. So we have Serbian illustrator Irena Dubrovna, played by French actress Simone Simon. Has a meet cute with perky engineer Oliver Reed, played by Kent Smith, when he catches her sketching a Black Panther at the Central Park Zoo. They start dating by hanging out in Irena's palatial apartment with the lights off mostly. Eventually, she reveals that she believes herself to be a descendant of her village's cat people, enslaved former Christians who turned inward toward witchcraft and fled amid persecution by their own king. What this means is if she gets impassioned by any strong feeling, she risks turning into a panther and wreaking havoc. So she can't consummate her marriage to the drippy man she inexplicably loves, and she can't abide his increasing intimacy with his chipper work wife, Alice, played by Jane Randolph. Irena tries to be good until it's time to be bad in this atmospheric B-horror from director Jacques Tourneur and RKO producer Val Lewton.
And Emily Blunt is also in this film.
Not this time.
Oh, no.
Not this time.
Okay.
I'm glad you described him as drippy. That's exactly the word I wrote down in my notes.
Is it? I can't stand him.
What a drip.
Can someone tell me what that means? Because my kids use that, but it means like cool now.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a different thing.
Oh, no, that's drip. Yeah, that's different.
Okay. Because they've been walking around the house the last 2 weeks just saying, oh, that sounds drippy. And I was like, I don't know what we're talking about.
I don't know that that's exactly what they're saying, but
we mean it in like a 50s way or something.
Yeah.
You do not mean like extra cool.
No. It's the antithesis of drip.
He's the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is very not cool. I love him.
You love him?
What?
Oh, wait. Who are we talking about?
The husband. Oliver.
I love the line readings that he gives. I don't love him as a character. I'm sorry.
Like, tell me what you love about.
The very wooden, like... I can't prove that the intent was satirical, but it seems like a lot of it's in that Criterion essay where it's like he's kind of like saying this is like an Americano, as he calls himself, bizarrely. And that it's, the whole thing is just setting him up as like this is what Americans are like. And I don't know, a really typical 1950s American male who has no clue. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not like the Don Draper mysterious 1950s guy. He's like the... Leave It to Beaver as a grown-up 1950s guy, but with the super, I'm guessing, fully making it up, but dark side to him that we just never really see. But there's a shadow side to that guy for sure.
Yeah. I don't believe that the actor was aware of the satire. I don't think so.
You think he's trying to act like that?
Oh, I think so. But I do believe that the producer and perhaps the director were aware of that satire. Yeah, that essay you're referencing, the Jeffrey O'Brien one, is an all-timer.
It's brilliant.
So good. And I know we keep saying 1950s because that was my fault. I said that the term drip is very 1950s, but the film is very 1940s. Yes, just want to, in case we go too far down that road.
And the name Oliver, I think, is great.
I love Oliver.
I just like a lot of little things. I do not like him as a character, you know, the way he comports himself. But I think some of the dialogue, which I know he didn't write, but he just delivers it so stiffly. And it's so, you know, I've never been unhappy. And hey, you're normal. You married. You're normal.
Oh, my God.
Until, you know, and I've never. That's my problem here because I don't know how to solve it because I'm always happy. You know, I had a great childhood. They teach you first day of, you know, first week maybe at grad school. Anyone who says that they had a happy childhood right off the bat in therapy, 100% didn't have a happy childhood.
Oh, interesting. The therapist perspective.
It means they're saying, do not ask me about my childhood because it was fine and we're not going to look at it.
Oh. Yeah.
They're trying to ward you off in advance. So, I mean, not every client, if any of them listen to this, but... So anyway, he gave me a lot of those vibes of like, I think he's the one that needs to see the therapist, not all these other people. So.
Oh, 100%.
Sorry to throw you guys off there because he's not the most exciting part of the movie by any stretch.
No, I would love to start by talking about how much he sucks.
Then let's go for that.
You know?
Do you think that Irina, is she attracted to him or is she attracted to like her idea of normality?
Oh, that's a great question.
I mean, that's what it feels like, you know? Like, yeah. She's trying to cling to him.
I feel like it's the latter.
Yeah.
We meet her alone at the zoo. I love that she's sketching. And then we get the shot of, like, what she was sketching. And it's this, like, fucking deranged, almost like a trad tattoo, kind of a panther with, like, a huge sword going through it. Like, she is not drawing from reference, as one might assume, based on the fact that she's standing by the cage. She just has this, like, totally charismatic darkness that I find so compelling in contrast to her appearance. And I read that Simone Simon was like cast for her little kitten face. And she really does have this cute kind of snub-nosed, like adorable comportment. And then to think about that being the veneer under which this kind of like roiling horniness and anxiety and possible violence is kind of like moving around is like so interesting. And I know, Miriam, that we both just recently rewatched the Paul Schrader remake of this film, where that's a lot more at the surface.
Yeah. In fact, I watched that for the first time. I hadn't seen it.
Oh.
And in preparation for this, I watched it. And I mean, I was totally blown away by it. But the comparisons are so interesting.
Yeah.
Even in terms of like in that film, it's completely just horniness that she's afraid of. But in this film, it's like, I think more relatable because it's like she's not just afraid of like an ancient myth and incest and her losing her virginity. She's in the Paul Schrader film, those are the big fears, which are maybe a little bit less relatable than anger and jealousy and just unreasonable passion.
Any big emotion.
Totally.
Yeah, big emotions. Like she's like that scene where she's like, where Oliver says she's going insane, but she's just like, what does she say into the couch? She's just like, I love the silence. I love the loneliness. Yes. I love the strength, warm.
She loves the darkness, I think.
It's such a moving scene.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like teenage emotions, you know, just like big emotions. And I just find that that psychological, that like very relatable psychological, having your emotions overpower, you know, being bigger than you, or a fear of hurting someone. She has a fear of hurting someone, you know, and that's like, for me, it veers more to the like psychological stuff, you know, psychological
oh, big time,
or more so than the like inner guts of the panther and the cat people and the Paul Schrader, which is just a little much for me.
It's wild.
Yes. And very, it was also very 80s. Yeah. It was in the soundtrack. Yeah.
Great soundtrack.
But Veronica, you watched that this week too, right?
I did. Yeah. And I do have the soundtrack on vinyl as well.
Oh, but, nice.
I mean, I like the Schrader. I find it sort of outrageous.
Sort of.
No. Yes. It's fully.
Yeah.
Comprehensively it's outrageous.
Capital O.
Especially because. Yeah, it has this really sensational treatment of a film that's so restrained. Like the original film is so effective in its restraint, I think, and like still really expressive. When I think of cat people, I mean, the plot of the film is simple enough. Like she meets Oliver. They end up getting married quite quickly after a short courtship. Oliver gets closer and closer to this work wife, Alice. And my contention is that cat people is about like the scourge of work wives. Like how you should like not allow your partner to get close to people they work with, basically, at your own risk. And then he's basically like, I'm actually in love with Alice. And she just has to sort of deal with her jealousy. At the same time, there's this threat of institutionalization because he makes her see a psychiatrist who does, I'm doing scare quotes. This is a podcast. I feel like I have to say I'm doing scare quotes because he puts her under like hypnosis ?
That's confusing.
But also tries to fuck her. It's extremely confusing and totally inappropriate. And then eventually things just kind of explode a little bit at the end. But it's a quiet, everything about it's quiet, even the culmination.
It doesn't explode. Yeah, it's a very, like, a quiet explosion even.
Yeah.
The psychiatrist is definitely the scariest part.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and that's also a real fear. I mean, I'm sorry, Chad, but...
Oh, don't worry. I'm not a psychiatrist. Psychiatrists also scare me.
This is so 1940s too. Like that 1940s interest in psychoanalysis and that kind of thing. But like using her hypnosis to stalk her? And then to fuck her? And he's so being very inappropriate. And I feel like... Everything is this sort of inner turmoil.
But also this, just his assurance that he's right about whatever he's saying that's coming out of his mouth. As he's diagnosing her and making up all this stuff and kind of half misquoting Freud and throwing all this other stuff in there. And
right.
The whole approach to it is antithetical to everything I know about how to help people.
Good. Actually, and something you're saying, Chad, about his like modernity, like, you know, and he has a line that's a little bit mysterious and that I just kept thinking about and was thinking about it in your notes as well, Veronica, where he says that, Irina, you're afraid of the past and she's afraid of the present.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
He's alluding to the Alice, the work wife's
right.
feelings for Irina's husband. But I thought about that more and it's like, a lot of the fear scenes are about Alice, the woman who Irina, our cat woman, is jealous of.
Right.
And the funny thing is Irina seems more comfortable in the city than Alice does.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that line that he has, like, you're afraid of the present. It is about, like, Irina's more comfortable in this urban world. And the scene, honestly, maybe one of the most effective scary scenes and one of the first is when Alice is walking in the city and you hear her footsteps and then you hear, like smaller, louder footsteps. And that's so good, that fear, like, you know, familiar footsteps. That's super psychological. You know, that's something that is just like triggers something in you. But in a city, and then the way the roar of the panther becomes the roar of a public bus. Like, I feel like it's in some ways about this fear about this urban landscape that somehow, isn't it funny that this woman from the old world seems to thrive in it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the, you know, modern city stuff? Veronica, you had noted some things in it.
Well, the shift in terms of scholarship from classic to modern horror is usually historicized to 1960 and this moment of like Psycho moving the horror film from like a old world, as you said, like a kind of Transylvania, foreign, exotic locale to somewhere that is modern, urban, recognizable. But obviously, this is 1942, and it really does strike me that we're so in New York in this film. Everything about it is sort of recognizable, but then you also get this sense of how history is still around in the museum that they go to, in the brownstone that she lives in. There's still this opportunity for, like, almost in the same way that film noir makes the city a space of darkness and shadow and fog. I mean, everyone's smoking cigarettes in this movie. There's a kind of like obfuscation going on the whole time. So even though there are more people, it's really convincingly frightening. And especially when the people sort of drop away as they do it in that moment with the bus shot with Alice. Yeah, I do. I think you're totally right that Irina has more facility with the space in a way.
Yeah.
And I love seeing Alice get scared because I hate her.
The work wife.
This is very interesting because I did not have these reactions to Alice at all.
Oh my God. She's so annoying.
She's horrible.
When Irina says, Alice?
Yeah. You know, I'm like,
that face.
100%. That is a timeless moment.
Oh, annoying.
Yeah. Like, you're bringing up Alice? Yeah, totally. Yeah. I know. I just recently watched for the first time Gene Tierney's Leave Her to Heaven. And
For the first time.
Yeah.
And when I was watching that, I'm like sort of Googling it at the same time. And I was just like, how is she supposed to be this iconic femme fatale when she just wants to be alone with her husband? Like, she just wants these family members to leave them alone so they can be alone. And then she's like, I think you're in love with my sister. And then he fucking is.
Is it her fault she's perfect? It's not.
It's not. Yes. As a sometimes interpreted as like kind of glacial woman, I felt very targeted by this movie and the idea that like you don't have, I don't know, like real human warm feelings if they're not super legible. And that same thing of like a really sort of, I hate to say it, but like a really basic woman versus like a more complicated woman feels like it's totally at work in Cat People too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I think Alice even says something about that. Like, I don't think she uses the word femme fatale, but she's like the new kind of other woman or something.
Right.
Because she's just reasonable and there in a sort of manipulative way. She's just, I'm just a normal girl next door. And you're just like, I know. That's so deliberate.
It's so annoying. It totally reminds me of that Joan Crawford quote of like, if you want to see the girl next door, go next door.
Oh, I've never heard that before.
That's good. Good. No, I'm glad we have the same feelings. Oh, I have another thing about the modern urban space as being this like place of terror. Because you noted, Veronica, like that horrible scene where Oliver says, oh, unhappiness? I've never been unhappy. He's like, I've never heard of it. I've had a happy family. And they're at the water cooler, which is like such an, like, you know, modern.
The literal water cooler, yeah.
Yes.
And then yeah. You see there's actually an echo of the water cooler in the pool scene later. Because mm-hmm. you see the kind of waves in the water. And then you see that exaggerated 100 times in the pool scene, the famous one that we had mentioned.
You know what Martin Scorsese would say about that?
What? What?
Yeah, I always wanted you to say that word again.
Psychosexual. That's right. That's the Scorsese way. It's amazing. Yeah.
Sorry.
For her, the office is like kryptonite, you know?
Yeah.
Like when Alice is mm-hmm. there yeah. and when they're there, because she's the, as you said, she's the Alice's work wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're being a little hard on her, but I like it.
I mean, she gets what she wants in the end. So I feel like,
true.
You know, she's fine. I mean, there are such like iconic scenes in this movie from a horror perspective when the bus emerges and we hear this kind of like proto jump scare with the bus. And then the pool scene that we've been talking about when Irena like appears and has kind of been like menacing Alice. And there's this question that takes the form of like the shadows on the walls of whether she is turning into a cat or not, which remains for much of the film sort of an open question, I think. Mm-hmm. To me, there's this like horrifying moment when Oliver and Irena are fighting about Alice. It's revealed after Irena's first appointment with Dr. Judd, and she comes back to the house and Alice is sitting on the couch next to Oliver, that it's actually Alice who recommended Dr. Judd as a possible therapist.
Yeah.
Such a crazy violation of privacy and of the sanctity question mark of their marriage. And she's so upset about it. And it's framed in such a beautiful way with Irena kind of in the middle of Alice and Oliver kind of with their backs facing camera. But then afterward, when she's talking to Oliver, she says to his suggestion that Alice would understand, there are some things a woman doesn't want other women to understand. Mm-hmm. And I just find that to be like so powerful, like one of the most potent moments of the film.
Yeah.
And one of the scariest moments of the film, even though it's not as generically loaded.
What hits there for you so hard?
It just feels really true. And also the fact that she has to say it and he clearly doesn't get it feels really true.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't get most things.
Yeah. She's so distraught. And it's like, why? This is, you should know this, you know, like you should. Yeah. Her line readings are so good. I feel like there's so much of the film that we're so familiar with it. So we're not commenting on, you just mentioned how like it's always a little unclear if she's turning into, I mean, there's just so much mystery, especially compared to the Schrader, where in fact,
no mystery.
If there was any mystery, by the time you get through like an almost perfect hour and a half, then there's this like coda where everything's explained in this like ridiculous way. And it just keeps going. I wrote down when I was comparing him, like, Paul's afraid of the music. Like, he's just afraid to let the music speak for itself, which is crazy because he has these like Bowie and Marauder, and he's like the literal music. There's so much mystery, though. I mean, he needs everything to be literal. And this film is really quite the opposite in that there's just so much mystery, so much unexplained, and so much literal shadow.
Yeah.
Everything that's fearful is just what may lurk, what you can't see. And so what you can imagine, which is always scarier than what you can see.
Yeah. I mean, that's the biggest like psychological maxim there is.
Yeah.
The unknowable is always more terrifying and always more anxiety provoking.
Yeah.
Even if the worst case scenario is true, it's still better than not knowing. for the most part, for our brain. Another thing about it is kind of how it's been, I'll explain this after I say it, kind of like Citizen Kane in a way, meaning if you show Citizen Kane right now to like an 18-year-old, they're like, I don't get it. What's the big deal? Mm-hmm. And that's because it's been so, all the things that Welles did that were, you know, innovative at the time, camera work-wise and a lot of other stuff, it's just been, you know, immersed into the cinema ever since. And is so it's just like they've seen all that stuff and they don't realize, no, this was the first person to do it. So like you mentioned the bus scare, which was called, I mean, I think some people still call it, it's called the bus or buses or something like that.
Buses, whenever, it was afterward for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a jump. He basically invented a jump scare. I mean, I know I did read about it today that there was one earlier than that, but he was kind of the one that kind of brought it into some form of mainstream stuff. And then he put it in all of his films. And now, I mean, imagine watching a horror movie that doesn't have something like that in it. Mm-hmm. But if you watch that now, it doesn't seem innovative or groundbreaking because you've seen it 100 million times. So I do think some of the coolness of this is that, it's just that it's this kind of weird, poetic, elusive. I mean, you can't really put your finger on what feels off, but there's just so much running throughout the film where you're just like, this feels off in some way. Even Oliver's wooden line readings, whether they're intentional or not. Everything just, I know Veronica put uncanny in her notes, but that's really, I mean, it's like a whole, it's like 73 minutes of the uncanny.
So Chad, when you use he there, do you mean Turner or do you mean Val Lewton? Because I feel like that this is a film where there are kind of two auteurs, at least.
Yeah, that's a tough question because I kind of use them as a unified person. Yeah,
fair.
The first time I saw the Martin Scorsese Personal Journey of One Same as You, and immediately it's like, whatever this movie is, I got to watch it. Of course, it was not a time when you could just open up your computer and find anything. So I got it from the video store, but it was part of the Val Lewton collection. So I've always thought of it as a Val Lewton film, even though I know, you know, Jacques Tourneur. Because I love Out of the Past. That's one of my favorite film noirs. So it's really weird that I never think of this as one of his films. But of course it is. I mean, he directed it. They worked very closely together. It's just very odd that a producer is given almost like auteur status in the way that Lewton was. But I do think of it more as Lewton. But I have no proof of that. It's just a hunch.
I mean, especially when we're talking about B movies, like working with like limited resources and like using the shadow because turning off the light is cheaper than making some kind of plastic ketchup gore coming out of things. Should we talk a little bit about Val Lewton's past, how he got into making these like very cheap B movies?
Yeah.
So there's a really great, not to plug another podcast on our podcast, but
plug away.
Well, we might as well, right?
The more the merrier. I love podcasts.
There's such a great economical overview of his time at RKO in a You Must Remember This episode, an old episode, which is funny because listening to it recently, I was like, oh, this is what they used to sound like. Like, it's quite different from the like erotic 80s series. I'm not going to say it slow.
Still got the Karina voice though.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But it sounds like it's on 1.5 speed or something. But horror at the time, following this like run of Universal big horror films, formulaic horror films, was like so popular for in Hollywood. And RKO like wanted in. And interestingly, Lewton like fully just rejected the Universal template and wanted to do things his way and thought they could be done subtler and like in more oblique ways, which I think is really visible in his filmmaking. And so he's put in charge of B-movies. All of the horror conceived thereof was based on studio-tested titles. So Cat People, I love this idea that it's like you get a prompt and you're like, okay,
make a movie,
make a film, make a featurette. Here's the title. What are you going to do? And then this is what you do, this like incredible meditation on female interiority and urban fearful landscapes and animals and humans. I mean, it's just, it's so interesting. And all the films had to be under 75 minutes and under $150,000 budgets. And then eventually, with the popularity of the films, Lewton was offered more of an A-movie role and rejected it because he knew that he would have more control if he was working smaller. And I think that is something, I don't know, as like a writer and doing this podcast, like it just makes a lot of sense to me that when you have less... If you have less resources, you probably have less oversight. And the fact that that's been industrially true for a really long time is totally heartening and very punk, I think.
Yeah, you see Barbarian with the success of that film right now. Yeah. And that's always been true. There's always an audience for these genre films. And you're able to do more with them because they're cheap and they're going to make their money back. And mm-hmm. so there's so much more you can do. And I think the thing with Universal, their thing was that you had to see it. You had to see yes. the monster. You had to see the horror.
Didn't they like force an insert?
Yeah. And I think exactly. And I think that he thought it would be more effective to leave it to the imagination.
Yeah.
And he's right.
Yeah, I think he is. And I also just want to say quickly with this low budget idea, I work a lot with emerging filmmakers and with filmmaker development. Mm. And I'm always trying to urge them towards making these B movie style, like these Ulmer, Val Lewton, you know, pre-code kind of things, because they're just so effective, especially when they're like 75 to 85 yeah. minutes. There's such a better model for a beginning filmmaker yeah. than to try to make like There Will Be Blood or something. You know, like there's always filmmakers who want to make their masterpiece and they end yes. up, you know, it's like, no, just start B movie, start pre-code, start with these, like, you know, they have the same production models of just making mm-hmm. it like fast, cheap, and yeah. effective. And like with that, as you said, less oversight mm-hmm. because they would make their money back and there was less risk. So there's more mm-hmm. imagination. And I think it's in that Jeffrey O'Brien thing. Val Lewton was known, at least like Kent Jones made it actually a documentary on him, and which I didn't rewatch recently. But Val Lewton was a big, considered himself very kind of literary.
He wrote poetry, yeah.
He wrote poetry and pulpy novels.
And pulp novels.
Pulp novels. And I think, like, you know, his famous line was that when they asked him to make horror, he thought they meant horrible novels. And they yeah. heard that he wrote horrible novels and someone misheard it as horror.
Amazing.
But you see that. You see that, like, sort of, like, bigger themes. And I feel like there's also always things about, like, gender and race and I Walked with a Zombie and yeah. and these like bigger themes that are mm-hmm. emerge without being quite spelled out and become more powerful because you can do so much projection onto them, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. Yeah, he suggests a lot but doesn't fill in a lot.
Yeah. I feel like there's an underappreciated auteur in this film too, is Mark Robson did the editing.
Oh, yeah.
And he also worked with Val Lewton later. He did The Seventh Victim mm-hmm. and he edited a lot of these classic ones, I Walked with a Zombie. And later on, he went to make this film, The Bridge Over Tocorie with William Holden, which is underseen and just like so beautiful.
I haven't seen it, yeah.
I really feel like this is like a power trio of Mark Robson,
yeah.
Val Lewton, and Turner, obviously. And Turner brings, I think, that style of lighting. Oh, and of course, the cinematographer, Nicholas Musaraka.
Yeah.
It's great.
I'm amazed you knew it off the top of your head.
I did not just have to check my notes and ask someone else how to pronounce it.
I love that.
But yeah, no, the cinematography is just wonderful. Mm. All I can think about whenever I haven't seen it recently and I don't fully remember much, I just remember how it looks.
Yeah.
And just
yeah.
the crispness, once Criterion got their hands on it, just the crispness of that transfer. I mean, it's just, oh my goodness, the blacks and whites. And I can hear Martin Scorsese in my head.
It's beautiful.
Just talking about how brilliant it is. Yeah.
Well, I know we were talking before about like if me saying something about Miriam, you creating ephemeral communities was like strange in the intro. But I guess this is exactly what I mean, is this curation of your team, being able to be like, these are my guys. Like, this is who is like on the same aesthetic wavelength, has the same priorities, like a kind of recognition of shared sensibility, which is something that isn't visible everywhere. But I feel like once you see people in conversation with the same people again and again, there's something kind of like reliable and inspiring about it. And it's funny that we're talking about, I think, exactly that in terms of Lewton's curation of like a set of creative collaborators that would sort of get his vision or his like priorities, even like his investments, like what is most interesting in storytelling, which I think often is about like ambiguity, ellipsis, showing less. And as a result, everything looks so like sophisticated uh-huh. in a way that the Universal films, which many of them I really love, don't. Like, there's a kind of obviousness to them that's a little bit clunky, I think, now.
Yeah. No, that's interesting that you bring that up. And thank you again for that. But and I think that there's something very true about, well, at least what my sensibility and the sensibility I'm drawn to. And so the filmmakers who are involved in Indie Memphis and maybe before La Di Da. Mm-hmm. There's a filmmaker who just screened the U.S. premiere of his film, his new film, Don Juan. This film, Serge Bozon. And he's a filmmaker and also a critic and really interested in B-movies. And in fact, I should have asked him some advice on this. There's a style of lighting. It's called aquarium lighting. And it comes from Turner and Lewton.
Oh, wow.
And it has to do with these pools of light. And he references it all the time as like a B-movie aesthetic that he's so interested in. Obviously, you can see it in this. I wonder actually if the term comes from the pool scene. I'm not sure.
That's interesting.
I should know more about it.
It must. Yeah. I mean, because as soon as you said aquarium lighting.
Aquarium lighting. Yeah.
I love that.
As soon as you said that, I just thought of the, I mean, I just think of the pool scene immediately.
Yeah.
And there's so many interesting choices too. Like, I don't even know. Is it a Karasker? Whenever like she's on the therapist couch for the first time and he decides.
Yeah,
to, like,
it's almost completely dark. And there's like a little.
Zoom in and put her in like a spotlight and like a floating head. And yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because it's a diegetic light source in that scene. Like then we see him.
It? Where is
like,
it coming
the lights
from?
On and there's like a sun lamp or something.
That creepy psychiatrist putting a spotlight on her.
Yeah. It turns the like therapeutic space into an interrogation room or something. It's so weird.
Yeah. I mean, I can kind of see what he's trying to do there, but at the same time, I mean, meaning the psychiatrist, not the cinematographer.
Right.
But at the same time, it's just, it's such an odd choice, but again, impossible to look away from and impossible to, you literally have to focus on what they want you to, because there's nothing else to focus on. It's just all darkness and then her face.
Yeah.
And then he kind of brings back that, or at least an echo of that same shot later on, but adds to it all this crazy cat stuff.
Yeah.
Really bonkers. And that's the only time I laughed in the movie, not at a line reading, was when the person shows up in the visual. I'm not going to explain this right. Do you guys know what I mean? There's all the cat stuff. She's on the couch and he's saying like, sometimes fear needs to be unleashed or something like that. And she's kind of going through all this cat imagery in her head. And then all of a sudden this figure appears. It might be the King John. I don't know who it is.
Oh, it is with the sword.
This figure appears dressed and he just looks so goofy. That's like the one part of the movie when I'm like, oh no, this is a B movie. Yes, when he shows up.
Because they're trying to show stuff.
The rest of it worked, but when they're trying to show him all, I was like, no, this is silly.
The cat stuff is kind of funny. Oh, we didn't even talk about one of the creepiest things that Oliver does. On their second date, he brings Irina a Siamese cat as a present.
Yeah.
What a jerk.
I forgot about
that. Can you imagine bringing someone a cat?
That he's been keeping in a shoebox on his table all day at the engineering office.
Yeah, that's what.
Bringing a pet and that breed, a Siamese, never a third date. Perfect.
But I saw it as his like ill-advised, like not malignant, but as ill-advised, typical American kind of man who's like, oh, this is a great idea. She mentioned something about cats, so I'm going to buy her a cat. And just didn't think it through at all beyond that.
Yeah.
The taking care of a cat for another 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Such a terrible
That sucks.
Present.
It is pretty bad.
It's really bad.
But it's him like trying to show that he's in love with her and he's a normal person and he buys her a cat.
I don't really buy that Oliver is ever in love with Irina. I think he's attracted to her, interested in her.
That's all it is.
You know,
he's attracted to her, and then he finds out that he does not get to even kiss her because of this ancient curse she believes in, and so then he's out.
I mean, the fact that she makes that candlelight dinner, and then he doesn't even sit down, and he's like, it's too late. Come on. No way.
Yeah, he's awful. Something I'm just thinking about is it's kind of funny the film's relationship to, like, cats, like pet cats, because she's connected to this panther, but actual like cats hate, you know, like she doesn't have a kinship with actual cats. They know there's something wrong with her before anyone else does. And that's interesting that they're another kind of cat. Yeah, there's that funny old lady in the pet shop, you know, where she's oh lordy dearie, cats always know, or whatever she says.
Yeah,
Veronica, what do you think, why are cats not a kinship with her?
I was thinking about that on my rewatch too, because it feels surprising that they seem like there's a rivalry, some kind of, you know, like atavistic predator-prey thing going on. It just makes Irina seem that much lonelier because she isn't really close to the cat woman, as she's, I think, credited, who calls her sister at like the wedding reception dinner, whose advances Irina kind of rejects. She's not really close to anyone, and even animals. She can't experience something like communion there either. And it's weird because at least in the Schrader, I mean, it's subject to the whims of a crazy incest plot, but there is the possibility of some kind of relationality that I think in this movie is just, it's totally withheld from her. And it just makes it that much sadder. It's such a lonely film to me.
No, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Because she loves the loneliness. She loves the loneliness. I love the silence.
Perfect. That's perfect. Let's do last call. Typically, we end every episode by asking guests to share the last thing they watched recently, not the rewatch for this, but something else, and then a quick video store style staff recommendation. So Miriam, we'd love to hear something you watched recently and something you would recommend to our listeners.
The last thing that I watched, it was a film called Tarzan and the Leopard Woman.
Ooh.
And I really watched this because it was about to expire from TCM. And mm-hmm. I had mentioned something to Veronica that I've been watching a couple of Tarzan movies for some reason. I find them so, so problematic and so interesting. Like their relationship to Africa and society. And I don't know. I just find them very much a rich text. But I am really interested in this one because it starred this woman named Aquanetta, who apparently told people that she was Venezuelan and native, but the black press really fully embraced her. And in fact, in research, it turned out she was light-skinned African-American, and she embraced these like other identities because she could play more roles that way. And she was like the definite like light-skinned black woman playing these sort of generic exotic roles. And that's what this was in The Leopard Woman. But it has a lot of similarities as this. It's like about unleashing. Oh, Chad, you'll have the terms for it. What are the strong basic feelings and like the sort of primal, like unleashing the primal as opposed to like very staid civilization.
It works.
Yeah. And but it was, I mean, it was probably even more B movie than this was. She was really fascinating. And for some reason, I'm very fascinated with these films.
What time frame was that made?
1946.
Oh, okay.
So really similar.
Yeah.
I had been watching more of the 1930s ones. Like, I really like the ones with Mia Farrow's mother, Marina Sullivan. I always get them mixed up.
Yeah.
Some of the Marines. Marina Sullivan. And she's amazing. And that she's the main reason to watch the earlier Tarzans that are in the 1930s. But this just replaces it with a different Jane. And she no longer has an English accent. And she has blonde hair instead of being a brunette. There's something very sexy about the early Tarzan movies. I mean, earlier before we started recording, we were talking about himbos too. And Tarzan is the ultimate himbo.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And so she's just like, oh, I don't want to go back to society. I just want this big, strong hunk in my life. Oh, Tarzan. But this woman, it becomes more domestic all of a sudden. So it's 1946 and it's getting closer to the 50s. And instead of the sort of like primal kind of like sexy relationship, she's like, oh, Tarzan, get some bamboo and fix the shower.
Like, I feel an essay developing.
Yeah. Sorry. That was a big ramble about
a
movie.
No. I mean that in a good way. I mean, like, you're drawing a lot of stuff in that feels like you could flesh this out into a big whole piece.
Yeah. It's not a movie that I think anyone really needs to see, but I got a lot out of it.
Which is why movies are so great.
Oh, and then a recommendation? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Gosh, I didn't think about this. Like an older film or a newer film?
Anything.
Literally anything that you like.
Yeah.
No judgments.
Gosh, at the festival, we just showed this film, The Inspection by Elegance Bratton.
Oh, yeah.
That is really good. I cried so much at this film. And afterwards, I told friends it was like the most I had cried at a film made after 1959. Because usually I only cry at melodramas, like classic melodramas or war films. And this just hit me. There was something. So I'm not sure when it's coming out. It's great.
And I don't know anything about it. So can you give me a little tiny piece of like, what is it?
Of course. So Elegance made a film, a documentary a few years ago that we played at Indie Memphis called Peer Kids. And it was about young queer kids who were experiencing homelessness. And it was and it came from his experience. And this is a fictional film. It stars Jeremy Pope as a young kid who's homeless in New York and alienated from his family, who's his mother's played by Gabrielle Union in a kind of amazing role. So he decides that his only way out of it is joining the Marines. Mm. It's not a plot, you know, that I feel like, oh, that's a film that feels very aligned with my politics and whatever. But there's something that is so, just so human about this film. Like everything, like he is such a wonderful person and it comes across in this film. There's so much tragedy and yet there's this feeling of just wanting to connect with people throughout every scene. And I think it's really beautiful.
Yeah, that would make me cry, but I'm a much easier crier, it sounds like, than you. So.
I cry easily, just don't cry at a lot of modern films, but there's something about classic melodrama, just like catharsis, that just hits me, and this hit me in the same way.
The catharsis, sure.
Yeah.
How can one see this?
It's released by A24, so it will be in theaters eventually, but I think it's only played a couple of times. It played TIFF, New York Film Festival, at our festival. I think it's about to play another one, and then I'm sure it'll be out soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize it was A24. I'm sure it'll be all over the place. I'm sure I'll have a sticker or a pin from it someday. Yeah.
Oh, this has been so fun.
Oh my gosh. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us. It's incredible.
Yeah, so cool to talk with you.
Oh, it was really a pleasure. And I'm so glad. It was so fun to talk to someone who had the same experience with this movie too, Chad. That's such a funny origin story. I love it.
I was all ready to because I know Veronica always asks that question. So I was ready to answer it. And then I was like, oh, the guest is literally saying what I was going to say.
That's perfect.
That's never happened before.
That's true.
Yes, I can picture where I was on the couch when I saw that.
Wow.
That whole series. I mean, I probably ended up watching every movie he talked about eventually. I remember the Duel in the Sun thing, which was he talked about that like it was the most amazing thing he'd ever seen.
Well, if you ever want to talk about a Jennifer Jones movie, I'm back.
You had talked about how that it was a door that had opened like this whole kind of new world for you. And I was like, and that's exactly what it did. Like, I remember how watching that said, like, I should switch my degree to, or my major to film. You know, this is like, I know I like movies, but when I hear someone talk about this, the way that like a really good English professor would talk about Jane Eyre or something, but he's doing it with like cat people. I was like, I want to do this. I want to learn how to do this. I want to study this. So it just, yeah, it set me off on a whole path. And Cat People now is one of the few I can remember from, the movies have faded over time, but I remember Duel in the Sun and very much the cat people scene. So
you just echoed my answer because I, at the time I was working, I was like at my first job in an art museum and really getting into film. And this was the personal journey was like, okay, yeah, I want to do this. And I mean, I don't think it was about one thing, but it was definitely part of that time period.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always a whole plethora of influences, but yeah, that was the one that I could identify. Seeing a couple of movies around that time and then also just hearing him talk. And I was like, I would watch, if he released a new episode every year, I'd watch the whole thing always. Even hearing him talk, what was it, a couple nights ago, did you guys see the thing online from the New York Film Festival?
Yeah.
I didn't watch it yet, but I will.
Yeah, it's not breaking news to say, like, you know, that box office stuff has ruined cinema. Hearing him say it, you just get all charged up. It's so good. He's just such a champion of everything that I like about movies, regardless of whether you like his movies or not. Just the way he approaches it. So we will see no Scorsese slander on our timeline.
Love his eyebrows, too.
Ugh. Oh, and the iconic. To read this month's issue full of essays exploring exploitation and the B-side of cinema, visit us at brightwalldarkroom.com. And you can also find us on Twitter at BWDR.
We would love if you subscribed, shared, rated highly if you can, reviewed positively if you could, and visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/brightwalldarkroom. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands. Bye.
Hey.
Bye. I'm sorry I said bye.
No, that's amazing. Join in. It's the choral bye.
Okay.
It's different every episode.
We're trying to get a tripart harmony, but
awesome.
Can't wait to hear what you have to say about Dr. Judd's therapeutic methods.
I'm dreading having to talk about him.
Chad, you're a therapist, Chad?
Yeah, almost 20 years, yeah.
That's so cool.
Thanks. Yeah, but I'm not the type. We have a little different school of thought.
I'm glad you're not the type.
Yeah. Though I have been eaten by one panther client, so.
Wow.
No. Don't put that panther thing in there. People will misinterpret it. I'll get canceled.
like the most uncancelable person I know.
Until now.
Until now.
Now I'm canceled.